So welcome to another edition of Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali, the founder of Paid Content. Welcome again.
Thanks, Mark. How are you doing?
Doing well. Just kind of getting all my video chat windows in order.
Yeah. How's that going?
It's going okay. I just, you know, everything's about video chat now, and I have to say that, you know, with Facebook and Google Plus really pushing video chat, and we had our kind of crazy experience last night, but I don't know. I'm not really a big fan of video chatting. It's just, it still seems a little strange to me.
Yeah, well, I'm sure the VCs won't hear what you're saying, but you'll see a new slew of all these video chat apps, like all those Instagram kind of apps that came out.
Right. So
I'm guessing now you'll see all those video chat apps, that kind of stuff.
So do you like? I mean, you must use video chat in just, or I mean, we both use Skype pretty regularly.
Yeah.
Do you use video chat, or I mean, what do you prefer if you're talking to someone who's in another country and you're kind of doing international calling? And do you prefer Skype audio, Skype video? I mean, what do you tend to use?
Well, I mean, we've been using Skype for a long time, audio mainly. The video, I think the only few times I've used, my family's back in India. So a couple of times I've used this was actually last month, not too long ago, to do a video conference call from my sister in Saudi Arabia, my family in Delhi, and then me here in the US, and we did a video call, and that was great. I think that kind of experience is great. When I first moved here to New York and my apartment was all done, I did a video tour of my house for my family through Skype video.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So it's been more special occasions than anything else, novelty more than anything else, but it could change. I don't know what.
It seems like for family, right? That because I noticed that too. That you know, with family, with you want to see someone you haven't seen them in a while, then it's a little different, right?
Yeah. I mean, usually I call India through my Vonage phone that I have, which is they have a package where India is free, UK is free. That's a lot faster. That's for daily use. It feels like. At least for now, it feels like video chat is more a special occasion.
Yeah, it does. And that's what I mean, I guess, that it's that it always seems like it seems more like I want to see someone, a loved one, wife, spouse, kid, those kinds of things where you really want to see someone and make contact. But on an average business call or you know, something that's a little bit more formal, then it gets a little bit weird if you're not that close to someone, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose some of it will change with something as easy as Google Hangout, where, I mean, you could see more business usage than personal usage, my guess is, at least initially, because you can see multiple people working from various virtual places if they're collaborating on something, especially if it's a physical product or something like that.
Let's go down what we will be talking about, just a quick rundown of our topics. First, we'll talk a little bit about Facebook made this their awesome announcement. They said they had something awesome to announce, and it ended up being integration of Skype video, one-on-one Skype video chat, along with group chat, text chat in Facebook, and we'll talk about what that means and also kind of compare that to what we've been doing in Google Plus. We'll also have on Marshall Kirkpatrick, lead writer and VP of content development over at Read Write Web, will join us and talk a little bit more about Google Plus. He actually broke the story of Google Plus and Circles back at South by Southwest, which he considers the biggest scoop of his career. And then we'll talk about the huge phone hacking scandal that's happened in the UK with the News of the World newspaper now saying it's going to shut down on Sunday because of the all the different reporters and editors and connection to Rupert Murdoch and just what's going on there. And also we'll talk to Tristan Stewart Robertson, who's a freelance reporter in the UK, who's written something for Media Shift on the topic, and just the topic of privacy and hacking and how the role that social media has played in the whole scandal now. So first, let's talk about the Facebook video chat announcement. They basically came out and Mark Zuckerberg was in person doing kind of a Facebook Live talk and, you know, kind of came out and said, this is the awesome announcement, and that they're integrating Skype. You know, how awesome do you think that was? I mean, a lot of kind of insiders were underwhelmed by it, but, you know, Facebook has a massive base of users, and if this is something that they'll like, we talked about video chat as a personal thing. If you have all your friends and family on Facebook and it's just so well integrated, it could be a pretty killer thing to keep people engaged.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the techies were underwhelmed, as you say. I think the awesome part is probably the backend integration, which Skype and Facebook probably had to ramp up their capabilities, the backend capabilities, so dramatically after they're doing this, because of course video needs a lot more bandwidth, needs a lot more resources and stuff. Yeah. So from that perspective, I don't think it was simple. I mean, even the Skype CEO said as much. I think from an integration point of view, it probably took a lot to make it as simple. I mean, you and I tried it out last night, and it seemed simple. The video quality, as you said, somewhere else, was that it was a lot better than, say, Google Hangout.
Yeah, we had at one point we were trying Google Hangout together, and then we tried the Facebook video at the same time we were doing a Google Hangout, which was a little crazy. And somehow I was in both places at once, which is bizarre. But we both noticed that the video quality on Facebook video with Skype was superior to the Google Hangout, just because I guess you've got multiple people with multiple connection speeds and some people dropping out if they didn't have a really good connection. And so the experience seemed a little bit better with Facebook video.
Yeah, it seems more, I mean, Google Hangout seems more YouTube-ish. I guess for obvious reasons, than good.
Well, and you can also, and it was funny, you were kind of pulling it up too, but you can actually pull up YouTube videos and watch them in Google Hangout too, which is
together,
kind of funny.
Together, that is quite interesting. I'm sure they will add, I mean, this is the start, YouTube is just the start. I'm sure companies will start paying for placement there and watch, I don't know, a movie together, that kind of stuff.
Right, and there's talk that if Google ends up buying Hulu, that, you know, you'd be able to watch your TV shows with other people and kind of do it as a group hangout.
Yeah, well, I mean, it remains to be seen consumer behavior there, but it would be quite interesting.
Okay, let's bring in Marshall Kirkpatrick and see what he has to say about all this, since he's one of the early people writing about it. Hey, Marshall.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Marshall, it's Rafat.
Hey, Rafat, I don't know that you and I have ever spoken before.
I don't think we have, which is very strange.
It's an honor to get to.
Yes. I'm sure one of these days I'll come to... You're in Portland or Seattle? Portland, right?
Portland,
yes. One of these days I'll come there.
Yeah, this show is all about bringing Rafat together with all the people he's dealt with. Perhaps to never talk to.
Never talk to, that's
that
true.
Sounds great.
So we were just talking about our experience. We had kind of a crazy experience yesterday where we were both in a Google Hangout video, and then we kind of brought up a Facebook video chat and had them both going at the same time just to completely overload ourselves.
Wow, yeah, you certainly can do that. Hangout itself can be overwhelming, but multi-person, multi-platform, that's ambitious.
For sure. So tell us, you know, what you you were kind of early on the story, as you said. You broke the story of Google Plus and Circles. So obviously, it was something that you really were looking forward to and excited about. Did it live up to what you thought it would be so far, playing around with Google Plus and with the video feature?
Well, Plus in general has surpassed my expectations substantially. I'm excited to see how the different levels of sharing and reading via the foundational Circles feature, how well that works out. I'm pretty excited about it. But, I had no information about the Hangout video conferencing feature at all until that went live. And it's a really, really compelling service, I think, especially when put in the context of the Circles, where you can group together people that are your coworkers or your family or your college friends or your future of journalism buddies or your big data buddies and open up a video chat just that's only accessible to those explicit groups of people. I think it's really compelling.
I'm also curious what you think about the way that Google has handled this whole Google Plus thing, because it seems to me a brilliant stroke to have it in this very closed kind of environment, and then basically bring in all the people who are the most influential people in tech, in social media, and have them all talking to each other in this kind of really almost like a circle in and of itself. That seems to have really paid off for them.
You know, there's probably a lot of different ways to look at that. I'm not sure that I would make the same assessment. One of the tests that we did on the first day that Plus was live was to put up a post and say, who around the world is on this network? Please put up post your location and a comment and a couple of words of what you think about the product. And we hit the 500 comment limit on a post between 2 a.m. when I posted it and 8 a.m. with people from all around the world. And I think that it's actually been pretty broad how much they've opened it up. They've put a real emphasis on speakers of different languages. And just this morning, they announced that they were going to open it up to twice as many people as had been in to date. So I think it's opening up faster and more broadly than it might appear.
I guess what I meant was more that, they seem to have kind of reaped some benefit in having it as this kind of limited power user group just as the first week or first few days, just because it made those feel people, it's kind of like, a favor in a way to all the people who they want to get on the good side, that they all got invites and they could kind of invite their friends. And even if it is a broad group, it makes the quality of what you see on it a lot higher. You're not seeing spam, you're not seeing kind of weird, you're not seeing the same level of kind of discourse that you'd see when it's open up to everyone. Although I guess the idea is that you really do have everyone in circles, so you should be able to limit what you see.
Yeah, the quality is high. I think that the structure of it in terms of the social engineering of the circles is intended to keep that quality high. And for me, one of the most surprising parts of it is that the engagement has been really high. I get far more comments and feedback on Google Plus posts, a week into it than I have on Twitter after years of using it and building up a community there.
But isn't that, Marshall Israfeth, isn't that a function of just the early adopter nature of it? I think the fact that we're talking a lot about the topics that that sort of are very near and dear to all of us just lends itself. I mean, Twitter, if I remember it correctly, had a lot more people following each other, and response rate, though I don't have any numbers to back it, at least I know people used to follow each other a lot more in early days of Twitter.
There's some of that for sure, but I think that there are other factors like the way that the posts that get responses get brought back up to your attention, either at the top of your stream or in a real prominent toolbar across all of the Google apps. I think that the way that people can leave longer form comments, original posts and responses as part of the increased engagement. And so I think there's a lot there that goes beyond just the early adopter nature and the navel-gazing nature of it that leads to that higher level of engagement relative to Twitter. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, in a month or 3 months or a year, whether that's still the case.
How do you think, if you were Google now to get people over from Facebook, is that your number one goal?
Well, I would say maybe. I think that the number one goal is probably to create a really compelling product that people like and overcome the years of stigma around the phrase Google doesn't get social. But sure, bringing people over from Facebook and Twitter is a big goal, I'm sure.
Yeah, and in that vein, I mean, there's this whole meme around, you know, Robert Scoble had this thing, you know, your mama isn't going to use Google Plus, and I don't care if she does. I'd rather just have it as this very techie, very geeky thing. You know, we had a video chat yesterday, or hangout yesterday, with a guy that was a programmer who said, you know, I love all the circles and sitting there and just getting into the nitty-gritty of who's in what circle and doing all that. Is that something that everyone's going to want to do? Is do you think this is the kind of thing that'll be as accessible?
Well, Mark Zuckerberg said yesterday that it won't, right? He said that millions of Facebook users won't even go to the trouble of sending or accepting friend requests on Facebook. Apparently, they just sit and stare into their computer and want it to do magical things for them with no effort put out at all. So, right. So his contention is that this idea of curating circles of friends organized by topic or relationship is just crazy. But Google has gone to great lengths to make it a really pleasing, intuitive user experience, the organization of your contacts. And I think that the value proposition of doing that is compelling enough that I think they're going to make a good run for it, and we'll see.
Marshall, what do you think about the Facebook video launch yesterday? The video chat.
Oh, I think it's pretty great. And if it hadn't completely had its thunder stolen by a much stronger product a week earlier, that it'd be a real nice announcement, and it is a real nice announcement anyway. You know, I think people will use it a lot for one-on-one calls, but you know, if I've got the choice between a tool that I can do one thing with and a tool that I can do more than one thing with, I'm gonna look pretty long and hard at whether more than one option is desirable. And in most cases, you know, the freedom to call one or many people, which is what Google Plus Hangouts offers, just sounds like a much stronger offering to me.
Have you played around with the video one and the other? I mean, have you noticed quality, any differences in kind of quality and things like that in the two services?
I have tested out both some. You know, the quality is such a challenge because it has to do a lot with bandwidth and connection. And, you know, I was testing Hangouts yesterday with some Canadians who are the finest people on earth, I think. And the connectivity, it was challenging enough that it was hard to know, you know, what was incurring the quality cost when there was one. But both seem pretty good. But, you know, Skype is, I believe, bigger than Facebook and is an incredible business. And even Skype, you know, has quality problems on a regular basis. People drop out and voices sound modulated and what have you. So we're still in the early days of all this. I mean, it's not quite two tin cans and a string, but it's that's not a completely inappropriate metaphor, I don't think.
It's funny because on our Google Hangout last night, the biggest issue was with one person who was from Toronto in Canada. So there must be some kind of weird Canadian issue with connectivity getting into Google Hangouts.
Yeah, Google Hangout doesn't like Canadians or something like that.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you joining us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure and honor. I really appreciate the opportunity. And yeah. I'll see you next in a Google Hangout, perhaps.
Yes, I think we'll do that.
Tristan Stewart Robertson is a Canadian freelance reporter based in Glasgow, Scotland, and is operating as the W5 Press Agency. He's written for PBS Media Shift about the Scottish elections and just wrote a piece about the scandal that's happened, the phone hacking scandal that's been going on now for a decade, really, in the UK. And just briefly to let our listeners know what's going on, you know, this story has really just exploded in the last week due to some reporting from The Guardian that's found that the News of the World tabloid in the UK back since, 2002, has been hacking into the phones of people involved in, there was a murder case in which they had the victim's phone, they had hacked into that phone. They've done it for, I guess there were celebrities, soccer players, politicians had their phones hacked. And when this all came up in the mid-2000s, last decade, it was just said that there was this one real rogue reporter and who was using an investigative reporter private investigator to kind of do the hacking, and that's all it was. And now we're finding out that this was a much wider scandal. So this has really been a long running scandal that's just exploded in the last couple of days, hasn't it, Tristan?
It's hard to going from forward to backwards. It's hard to describe how shocking this afternoon has been with the end of the News of the World after 168 years. It is, I'm pretty sure, still the world's biggest selling English language newspaper. It's certainly the biggest in Britain. It gets 4 out of 10 readers on a Sunday. For it to go, my journalism colleagues at various papers are just stunned, because it's certainly not what we were expecting at all, though we knew they were in trouble, certainly. The real change in pace came Monday, Tuesday, when, as you say, it was revealed that rather than just celebrities and politicians who had been targeted, it was innocent murder victim who they had hacked into her phone and were listening to messages left by worried family and friends, and in some cases deleting some of those messages to allow more messages to be left, but that gave the impression that she was still alive somewhere.
Does anyone have an idea of how they're doing the hacking? Was there a specific system? Were they just kind of doing a lot of guessing at PIN numbers, or did they, you know, have contacts at the telecom? Did they have contacts at the police surveillance? I mean, how does anyone know the method of how they've been doing the hacking?
I think from how I've read the descriptions of how they did it, in some cases they would call mobile phone companies and pretend that they were the account holder. If they had enough information about the person, pretend they were the account holder and say, "I've forgotten my PIN, can you reset it?" In a lot of cases, people don't reset their PINs on their voicemail anyway, so it would have been whatever it was when they bought the phone, maybe 1234 or 1111 or whatever it may have been.
Right.
And they've made a record of those ones once they successfully get into a person's phone. And it would only be if somebody realized that messages had been listened to before they listened to them that they would have been flagged up as potentially that somebody had hacked that phone. So technologically, probably not that difficult, just incredibly illegal and immoral.
Yeah, and so has that changed the way people even have their cell phones set up? I mean, are people being a little bit more cognizant of it now?
It may be that celebrities and high-profile people certainly are. I don't know because I don't personally know anyone who's had their phone hacked. I think once more details emerge, it will raise questions about how we do those. I mean, my voicemail I don't think I have any PIN, or I've never used a PIN on my voicemail.
Right.
So I will now think about that.
I would think so, just because now with all this happening and people realize how easy it is to get into your voicemail, no one really thinks, I mean, no one really thinks like who's going to care about your voicemail. But now with all this happening, it's just, you know, it's becoming such a high profile thing.
But I think part of that is people don't think that anyone's going to be interested. But as I've quite repeatedly said, we are obsessed with knowing everything about everyone. As a public, the appetite for gossip and for information is relentless. And it's only when that actually touches us individually, when the media spotlight turns on us as individuals, that suddenly we realize what that effect for a demand for information actually is. So, you know, we're all interested in celebrities. We all flip through those pictures and those, you know, the royal family and every possible thing that they get up to, until suddenly we become the story, and then we want our privacy. And that's the clash of a modern era where we put everything out on Twitter and Facebook and every digital medium, and then suddenly want privacy when it affects us directly.
Do you think, Tristan Zarafa, do you think there will be, do you it could potentially spread beyond News of the World? And is, I mean, clearly they're not the only ones doing it. I mean, it has to be. There has to be some institutional backing for this over the years, or do you think they have cleaned up over the last 5 years?
I think certainly News of the World may have cleaned up. Certainly the associate editor, who is now, as of this afternoon, 200 staff who have been laid off, he was on TV just tonight saying that he stands by his staff. The bad apples are gone. You know, the paper has been cleaned up in the last 5 years. Is it going on at other newspapers? There's always been the suggestion and the rumor, but I have not seen any proof. There's not been any court cases yet, or any arrests, or anyone from other newspapers being called in for questioning yet. That's not to say that won't happen. There's still clearly a lot more information to come out. If there are as many as 4,000 names in the private investigators' notebooks, then we're only at the tip of the iceberg.
What do you think about the role of social media in this recent part of the scandal, and how fast it's moved? Because I noticed here over the weekend on Twitter, I started seeing this hashtag of, you know, NOTW. And people I don't know how many people just saying, you know, basically asking all the advertisers of News of the World, you know, do you know about this scandal? Are you going to continue to advertise? And I mean, literally just putting the pressure on these advertisers who, I guess, to some extent did start to change their mind and say they weren't going to advertise or were reconsidering.
Well, I spoke to a couple companies today who said that they had started considering things already independently before getting much pressure from the public. Now, that may just be them saying that. Certainly, in an era of social media and the kind of pressure that it can put firms under, almost any firm is going to be aware of the potential for a campaign against you via Twitter or Facebook. I think some of the firms, and particularly Ford, was the first one to cancel their advertising, and they seem to do it very, very early on, before any social media campaign could get going. By this afternoon, before the paper was axed, it was getting particularly targeted at a food retailer, Tesco, who had declined to remove their advertising. And they were coming under sustained pressure, and I think it would have been interesting whether or not, under that pressure, they would have changed their minds in the next few hours. Obviously, at the end now, it doesn't matter because the paper will have one last edition. It won't have any advertising in it, and any money they've already received will be given to charity. But the News of the World made huge amounts of money in ad revenue. It made $600,000 a week in ad revenue alone.
I mean, it seemed like what I was seeing on Twitter was very ad hoc, that there wasn't actually someone organizing everyone. People were just kind of on their own. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it felt like it was just people on their own saying, you know, kind of rising up against them.
Yeah, I don't think I didn't get an impression that when I was, I've been looking at it, looking at the Twitter feeds quite a bit for the last sort of 24, 48 hours, and I didn't get a sense that it was being coordinated. Certainly once one person targeted a particular firm's Twitter feed, then people would retweet and people would copy and paste. But I didn't get a sense that there was a centralized reaction to that. And ultimately, I think, had the paper gone beyond this weekend, the question would have been, are the people who are on Twitter and are saying boycott the paper, do those translate into the 2.6 million people who bought the paper every week? And I don't know if those people are the same people, because, you know, they are... there's nothing to say that the people who use social media in that fashion are still readers of a downmarket tabloid.
Wow. What do you think? Do you have a sense that Rupert Murdoch himself might take a hit politically by everything that's happening?
I think the biggest risk, and this is what they've been trying to save, is the deal to buy BSkyB. So it's essentially Sky News, Sky TV, Sky Sports, all those different divisions, which apparently have an annual profit of around £855 million. So a huge potential windfall had they been allowed to purchase the 100% of BSkyB. That deal was supposed to go through within days, weeks. It is in question, but how much Rupert Murdoch has been involved, I don't know. His son James Murdoch was on TV today, even admitting that he was wrong to approve the out-of-court settlements to various celebrities, and that could put him personally at risk, as well as the deal to buy TV. So, and there's politicians connected at every corner to News International, whether they're afraid to speak out against News International in the past, or whether it's the Prime Minister who's been close friends and former boss to Andy Coulson, who was the editor of the News of the World at the time much of the phone hacking was going on.
Yeah, well, it's really fascinating what's going on there, and appreciate you giving us kind of a first-hand account being there, and you know, we'll look forward to your post that'll be on MediaShift pretty soon.
No, thank you. I mean, it's a fast moving. I'm having a hard time keeping track of all the updates that are flying on this one. So it is certainly going to change, and the story is not going away anywhere just because the paper's gone.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tristan.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS MediaShift, along with co-host Rafat Ali, founder of Paid Content. We want to thank our guests, Marshall Kirkpatrick from Read Write Web, and also Tristan Stewart Robertson, freelancer in Scotland. And we want to also thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister site, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/IdeaLab. We'll catch you next week.